side too.
Dude, nice buttons on the on the cuffs. They're great. Yeah. Sweet as. Yeah, I like it.
I deliberately replicated the thing from our photo for the first one, but we're going to have to remember to change.
Okay.
We're going to keep clearly changing each time. Let's do it, Ledge. Are you ready?
Okay. Well, hello.
Welcome to Kindred Spirits. I'm John Anthony.
And I'm Jason Fox.
And we're here to do a number on you, but we'll do everything we can to keep the abacus gelatinous.
Yeah, that's right, because we're not bound to, like, strict categorization of numbers. Like, the boundaries are, well, I guess gelatinous is porous, isn't it? There's some wobble. Isn't that what Alan Weiss said? Alan Watts. Not Alan Weiss, not the millionaire consultant guy. Alan Watts talked about...
the other Alan.
Wiggly lines, didn't he? Like gelatinous things? I'm pretty sure he did. Yeah. Anyway.
Sure. I mean, I just love the idea that, you know, is there anything worse than a solid orb? That's another way of spinning it, Fizzle. I don't like a solid orb. Keep it gelatinous.
Oh... Yeah, that's right. You know what, though? Saruman has one of the Palantir, which is like a pretty solid orb. It's what he could use to see everything, right? Too solid, yes. One might say. And then what's his name? Created the company Palantir, which is like this big evil security company inspired by the very thing that J.R. Tolkien warned everyone against. Don't put your faith in the solid orbs.
The
soften
twisted
orbs,
iron.
Folks.
Soften ye orbs. Yeah, gather ye right. And soften ye orbs.
Yeah, that's right.
Should that just be the tagline of the podcast?
Soften ye orbs Kindred by the fire. Yeah, that's right.
Kindred spirits, soften ye orbs. Yeah. God, I'd click on that, Fizz.
Cool.
So, legend. Let's put some loose structure around this. Why are we here? What are we doing, my friends?
Well, personally, I just love the conversations we have. And there is something so sublime as when you get two professionals get together to talk shop. And I'm particularly fond of the post-pretentious talk shopping, like the avoidance of podcast voice. Like, we're not performing for folks. We're not presenting and preening ourselves, because we do that on stage. You know, we've got our things. But, Absolutely. Gosh, it's so nice to just chat. So you're someone who vibes with the magic of emergence. There's a kindred spirit in that. And like, would it be nice to have other friends, like another friend join us who's listening right now, just hanging out? So I think largely... We're gonna have a chat. I'm gonna ask you soon what's on your mind, what's been happening. I have no idea what you'll say. And we're just gonna have a chat for a bit, like friends do. And then we might pop open a whiskey, do some, you know, pseudo tasting notes together, see what emerges. Then we'll land it somehow.
We'll land this fish, but let's also make it known to our friends that we are both holding on to the same whiskey, okay? So this is part of the premise, isn't it? We're not just popping random. There's the fumes of structure around this thing. We have ideas.
And in order to get the same whiskey was, you know, involved a flight on a plane, an exchange in an alleyway of some jars. Because, like, there is something about, like, oh, we'll talk about this a little bit, the whiskey tasting, but I genuinely consider whiskey to be a gateway to mindfulness, but also, like, a deeper kind of imaginative space. So it's just fun to share a whiskey in that sense. So,
oh, true. And there are so many things. Well, it's funny because, you know, there are many things that you and I connected over. One of them was pixel video game likenesses of ourselves. The next stop was whiskey, but there are so many things about it that I find so romantic. And one of the things that I think's just so special about it is what a labor of love it is. The amount of time and energy and effort and patience that goes into the craft, and then it's just so much around just the perseverance and the backbreaking work and just the history, the legacy, the echo, the ripple of it. It really is magic in the mouth, you know? And so I think, and there's just so much to find in there. And that's one of the things that I always find so fascinating is that you and I are going to be here later, moments into this, sipping the same whiskey, but we'll be having our own unique experience. And there's just something in that exchange that I think is really special as well. You know, along with what you said about savoring, sitting in the moment, mindfulness, and just not throwing your head back and opening the gullet and activating the trapdoor and binging it into your belly for the sake of it.
Totally. As you know, there's a lot that goes into context. Like, you go to a good whiskey bar and the lighting is just right, and it's not overbearing with like crappy music that's playing, and people aren't, you know, there's not the hens party and the bucks party all kind of like yoloing. There's a contemplative feel, which I quite like, but you know, we'll get to that. Let's talk shop a little bit. I'm curious, like, what's happening in your world? What's on your mind?
Well, it's funny because I've been looking forward to obviously this. And so you've been on my mind, my dear man. And something that I've been thinking a lot about this week in particular is not necessarily someone's origin story, but more the idea of personality construct, that story that you tell you about who you are. And I was thinking a lot about you this week, and I just wondered how it is that you believe that you became yourself. How did Jason Fox turn into Jason Fox? You know, what was the trajectory that led you to your current state? And then another thing that I'm sure you're going to love is, how married are you to your current personality construct? And you know, how nebulous do we keep this stuff?
We're going to talk about this. This is great because both you and I have a professional identity, and this is how a lot of people will see and experience us. Like, by necessity, we both dabble in the dark arts of social media. And you do it so fun. I love it. Like, so just, you know, for folks who know me but maybe not know JA, JA has the sublime talents, the wit, the insight, the acuity, the situational wisdom and playfulness, and the sense of magic, and all of those qualities, and he has not yet been corrupted by the industry. He still has a kind of an authenticity about him that's actually real, not manufactured. It's not I love it so much. And when I experience the part of you that manifests on social media and brightens up the kind of wasteland that is LinkedIn with all the bots and bros out there, and then suddenly you appear low and manifest with your kind of leprechaunish ways. Oh, I love it. I love it. But I also understand that that's not all of you. That's a part of you, right?
And so absolutely. Question,
yeah, go for it.
No, continue, my friend. Obviously I'm enjoying this because you're pumping up my tires.
Yeah, that's right. Well, where I was going to land is, like, you know, so the question is, you know, what parts of self that we kind of create, this kind of, what was the word you used? Was it identity? Was it?
I think I was thinking about being mindful of rigid self-construct. Or in this context, that story that you tell you about who you are.
Well, man, I've just been working on my website, so I'm so fucking sick of my story, like, and just having to, I don't know. So, but that's only a part of me. So the reason I'm kind of squirming with the question is because I'm of the belief that we contain multitudes, and there is this. Yeah, have you heard of the fourth way?
Yes.
Yeah, Gurdjieffian fourth way. So he's like the grandfather of internal family systems, where you've got multiple parts, which of course you'd be quite across. And so it's interesting, and it's interesting you ask me at the moment, because I feel myself like right in this protracted flux of a midlife crisis where I had developed quite an effective persona, you know, commercially effective. It was fun, it was joyous, and so on. but I feel like I've outgrown it, but I'm also not sure what the next version is. That's kind of where I find myself. But what about you? You're always fun and upbeat all the time, right?
Well, it's
how are you feeling about?
Yeah, well, it's a fun thing to wrestle with. So I was dragged kicking and screaming onto LinkedIn, and I did it in the heart of the apocalypse because a dear friend of mine, Hassan in the UK, you know, he's known me forever, over 2 decades. And he said, "Hey man, why aren't you on there making videos?" And I just found the whole idea of it so squeaky and shitful, but it was probably based on the garbage that I've been trawling through and just some of the stiffness and squareness that I like to think is on the way out on that platform. But as you say, it's turning into an increasingly buckled cauldron of bots and fakery and fuckery. And I tell you what upsets me, like really mundane things, like when you'll see a photo of a bus stop, but they've green screened the ad shell and slapped some bullshit quote on there, and then someone else copies that and that replicates 1,000 times. And so I went on slowly, right? I went on slowly, but I realized very quickly that the best way to roll on there is to do it purely from a place of service. And what I mean by that, legend, is not self-service. You know, if you look at the shit that I get into, it never ends with, "And so you should come to my seminar." You know, I just find that shit so squeaky. So I remember hearing this idea. Years ago, someone said to me, or I read something that said, "Listen and connect, don't perform." You know, this whole sort of archetypes that people play, and you know, I'm not a complete idiot. Like, I appreciate people are on LinkedIn to promote themselves and their business. You and I as solo pros pretending that we're not doing that just flies in the face of reality. But I think there's a way to do it that's sincere and genuine. And so when I'm on there, I'm doing it from a place of trying to be helpful. And I'll tell you something else is not going to lift your lid, because you're one of the smartest people that I know in real life. Often when I'm sharing people ideas of things that I think are going to help them, I'm just talking to myself, Fizzy, right? It's just me.
Oh, God, yeah, yeah.
It's me through the looking glass. Yeah. You know, if I say to someone, "Have you ever had this problem?" If I say that down the lens, what I'm really saying, I'm in the nucleus of this issue.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm going to crawl out of it by telling you what to do, you know?
That's great. We teach what we most need to know. I like that. I like the disposition. I've also, if we can kind of meander through this, there's a beautiful, rich question, because I'm currently navigating like the social media landscape, because other than seeing your stuff and this small handful of other really cool people that I love, it's a feed that does not make me feel good. Like, I don't often feel great after I spend time on social media at all.
Yes, you're staring false fire. You're staring into the false fire and you're poking with your stick a misery vortex. And that's usually what's happening.
Engineered for, you know, outrage or for, you know, despair or engagement and so on. But I do love connecting with folks and meeting folks. And one of the first things, one of the first things that I do, if I find someone, I click on their profile, I want to find their personal website. And then when I'm on their personal website, I want to find their newsletter. I haven't found your newsletter yet. Do you have a newsletter?
I don't, my friend. And I love when people ask me questions like this, because then I feel like I should. It's like when I speak to Leanne and she'll say to me, "Where's your book?" Or people like yourself who say, "Oh, where's your podcast?" You know, these things don't exist for me, my friend.
You have a literal like vinyl record of your beautiful voice and the craft of songwriting that you do. Like, you have many good things, and I certainly don't. I don't want to have you conform to the norms and expectations. But there is this thing where I'm like, we're in this transition from Web 2, which is where the platforms own all the connections, and then you've got all these folks flocking to Substack, which is Web 2.5. It's still, you know, venture capital backed platform centralized by a couple of dudes, but at least you can keep your email addresses that you get. And then ultimately where it goes to is like, there is something where the things that you do is so good. And it'd be like, for folks that aren't on LinkedIn and so on, it's like, it's just criminal that they don't get to experience you via other means. So anyway, just a gentle encouragement.
I appreciate you, brother, and I'm always open to advice. And I, you know, it's exactly.
Oh, shit! Did I just give you unsolicited advice? I'm just trying to express.
It wasn't unsolicited. It's appreciated. You know, it's like anything, mate. You know, when you're too close to a thing, you can't see it. And one of the things I admired about you was I actually felt like I liked you before I knew you. And it's because of the fact that you do have a newsletter, and I'd heard you on a couple of podcasts, and you have an amazing allure. There's something about you that's fascinating and difficult to articulate, but in your own way, you make yourself cryptically known, you know, and I don't know that I know how to do that. You know, I've had a few people who know me well say, oh, I tried to recommend you to someone and they looked at your website and they don't get it, or they don't get you, or it's not clear.
Oh, yeah, that happens.
And so maybe that is something that I should be concerning myself with. So, you know, I do mean that when I say I'm grateful for your suggestions, because it was only just yesterday that it occurred to me that I should have Linktree on Instagram to point people to my music and other things that I do. I don't really think strategically in that way, and maybe I should.
Yeah, well, I don't know. There's interesting questions, isn't it? Because the last thing we want to do is optimize. Because this is the trap that most people are in. They're like, we need to optimize this. And then that is a pathway to slop. Just to slop and just you know, hyper-efficient mediocrity. Just sprayed all over everyone. But
can I repeat something? There was something you said the other day that was so clever that I can't stop saying it. You referred to as AI as wait, let me get this. You referred to AI as optimization as a vortex to midwittery. That is so
yeah,
clever.
Yeah, it's clever. Well, I mean, I sometimes worry though that here's me smug with my, you know, these things that I make, but I'm like, I'm sitting the top of the hill, the top of the midway hill, thinking about how clever I am. But you know, so what I'm suggesting here is, like, you know, the clarity thing. Fuck that. Like, most people can do the hyper clarity thing. Like, the charm is in the mystery. It's in the kind of dynamic engagement. Like, you don't. Like, you and I resist categorization. Like, there is this generative both-endness to it. Like, it's you know, you want to keep the conversation alive, which makes it absolutely challenging to describe what you do exactly, to have other people refer you. But it's so true to the eclectic, generative abundance and, you know, playful disposition that us trickster folk have.
You called it. No, I was just going to say it. I think it's the trickster disposition. The second there's anything that feels too constrained or planned or rigid or processed, we're out. You know, we're out, or we're in there pretending, or we're in there doing it reluctantly, and it's leaving no space at all for emergence. That's exactly the reason why you and I have been so excited to start this podcast and deliberately had no real agenda in play.
Yeah. You know? It's
what we're both saying. The absence of an agenda is the agenda, legend.
Totally. And you know, I know you, like, you got a lot on in your world right now. but I look forward to potentially one of our episodes being like a long one where we can just ramble and meander and so on. I was trying to find you a quote from Trickster Makes This World by Lewis Hyde. There's this beautiful line in there about, I'm going to have to, can you just say something
yes,
really lovely for our listeners
Well, I think the reason why I started with that question was because I wonder what it would be, you know, this is going to make me sound strange, but I wonder what it would feel like to be as clever as you are. You know, I meant what I said before, brother. I don't really know anyone. I don't know many people in real life that are as smart as you. And that's why I was curious about the construct of your personality. I wondered what, you know, is there a, what was there a period when you were young when you sort of realized, hang on, I'm sort of things seem to come to me naturally. I seem to be able to retain things. I have an impressive turn of phrase. Without meaning to, I am running circles around people with my vocab, my observations. It just must have been an interesting awakening to come to discover that about yourself, Jace.
This is a lovely, like, we're fluffing each other up through this podcast, which is great. Which is lovely.
We're giving the abacus flatness, sir. We are on point.
Turgid. I saw this thing recently on Instagram, which I shared, just perpetuating. It is a brutal time to be even remotely intelligent. And I resonate with that. This is a lovely question. I shy away from any kind of autobiographical things about where it all came from, which, mostly because, you know, in our industry, in our profession, there is this weird, one of the perils is that we're asked this question quite a lot. You show up to interviews and so on. And every time you're just talking in real time, but then you notice things like, oh, that seemed to resonate, or that seemed to go well. And then there's this tendency to double down on that. And then over time, you've kind of crafted this beautiful story about things, which isn't necessarily true. And then it just becomes something you automatically repeat. So the TLDR of, I think it's really important to have epistemological humility in amongst this. I don't necessarily think that I'm that smart, but I am very interested across a lot of things, and my upbringing was in living systems, like ecological living systems, that then kind of transmuted into working with, well, I mean, I wrote a book called The Game Changer, which was, you know, me being in sycophant mode, trying to impress senior executives with the overlaps of motivation science and game design. And it just got my love for what makes a game work so well is so much to do about, like, the imagination, the player empathy, the world building and so on. And I just felt like I had to kind of make it make sense to folks. So I wrote some of the science principles and so on. But as the book came out, gamification became this big buzzword, which was such a superficial reductionist thing of points, badges and leaderboards and so on. And that just pissed me off, because I wanted my executive clients to actually think a little bit more and to be a little bit more curious and about the complexity of things. And so How to Lead a Quest kind of came from that. But mostly I'm just railing against folks that are just seeking quick fixes. And I found the quote. Can I share the quote with you?
Please, mate. Let's get it.
All right. So you'll resonate with this, right? Why? I suspect you will. This is from Trickster Makes This World, Mischief, Myth and Art by Lewis Hyde. Better to operate with detachment then. Better to have a way, but infuse it with a little humor. Best to have no way at all, but to have instead the wit constantly to make one's way anew from the materials at hand. Oh, gosh, I stumbled a little bit. Better to operate with detachment then. Better to have a way, but to infuse in a little bit of humor. Or best to have no way at all, but to have instead the wit to constantly make one's way anew with the materials at hand. Oh.
So good, mate. So good. You know, it's funny because you and I touched on this briefly last week, and there's a real beauty in it. When you get sent in to do a workshop, this is a sort of a mundane example, but someone sends you in a workshop and they might hand you a pack or a deck or an idea of what it's supposed to look like. But then if you're clever, you'll start by asking the room what they want. Hey, what are you hoping is about to happen? You know, why are you here? How do you want this to go? Totally. What kind of atmosphere are you looking for? And that's one of my favorite things, is when they tell you what they're after, your instincts tell you that isn't what this is, whatever the piece of shit on your laptop was about to be. And then you go full jazz. You go full jazz man. In and you create it with them on the spot. I mean, isn't this why we're doing this, mate? Yeah. Isn't this why we're doing
it? Totally. It's so enlivening. It's so, like, I had this thing where I used to have these beautiful slides that I would fuss over for forever, you know, typographically, you know, well gridded, golden ratio, proportionate balancing, like just sublime. And then there was this thing where the tech kind of gave up in one event, and I was like, I just had to go on. And I found it so enlivening when stripped of that, you know, the safety net, and just how present and alive and attuned you are. And the sense of, you know, I speak seemingly quite flippantly about magic, but I do, it really just depends on how you define magic, but there, you'd know this, it's an energetic thing. Like, you sense, like, there are pockets of, hang on, what's going on there? Something shifted there. And then just having the freedom to surface, like, because for any gig, right, there's four audiences, as I see it. There is the client who thinks they know what is needed, and they are the client. So you have to honor their wishes and so on. There's the audience. That's the stuff that is emergent and alive in the room. And then there's also yourself. You are your own audience witnessing yourself doing this. So you want to kind of be aligned and authentic and congruent. And then there's the wider world, because whatever you, whoever you're speaking to is like just a microcosm of the wider world. And so with these four audiences in mind, as you, and probably a secret fifth thing, I don't know, you kind of want to, you want to be free to surface what needs to be surfaced, but that's a different proposition to like dance with generative ambiguity than it is to kind of go in and do exactly what you said you'd do and what the client wants you to do.
And if you do that, you're only serving one of those audiences, or even worse, you're serving the audience that is yourself. And that's kind of vapid, isn't it? You know, it's funny because that self-awareness piece often comes through for me if I've done something a couple too many times, right? So, you know, you got to remember, I came up as a muso doing musical theater and plays. And you, when you're doing a play or a show that has a big run, one of the biggest challenges is when you arrive at a point that it starts to fall into autopilot, you know, and you start blocking and staging and timing and standing and saying and winking. And there's something about that manufactured approach to it that turns it into a performance. And this is the biggest glitch, isn't it? The second you start, often when I become aware of myself is when I can see me performing, and when it's acting, you blew it, you know, and we're back there again. Listen and connect, don't perform. If you're not listening and connecting, you're running that risk that you're just falling, you're bloody step walk changing, pot of bullraying, dance totally. 10, looks 3, baby. And
this is so beautiful. I like the sense of performance, though, the acting and so on, where there is almost like a channeling, like it's your ego self has stepped out aside and you're like fully in the role, you know? It's like there's this mythologist, Martin Shaw, he says that all great storytellers are on a journey from persona to presence.
And beautiful, mate. And you said it earlier when you spoke about energy fizzle, like, you know, it's funny because the word energy hit me hard, and it was funny because for a long time it was a trigger for me, because ever since I was a little kid, like let's say 9, 8 or 9, I've always been that actor, performer, singer, extra kind of kid. That's just my personality. I've always been that way, and you know, like it or hate it, there's nothing manufactured about it. But for years, I'd do something, and I put my heart and soul into it, and people come up to me and say, "Hey, man, you've got energy." And it was the only thing they had for me. "Hey, man, you've got energy," right? And I think the glitch was with me, Jace. But for years, I interpreted energy as just them saying, "Hey, man, you're extroverted." And it's funny because maybe this is on me, you know, maybe it's just all up in my own buckled little noodle, but I can remember thinking, but is that really all you see? Because there's so much more that I'm trying to bring to this than just a big fucking personality. There's so much that matters to me about this, around how this is going. And you know, better than me, my friend. You know, the things we read, the stuff we pay attention to, the references that we draw on, the magic that we're trying to help them to alchemize, is it just someone who's extra? Like, is that all it is? And it's I don't know, maybe I'm being overly vulnerable here, but I used to find it upsetting because I thought it felt two dimensional. Is that all you're fucking seeing?
Yeah, there's a kind of grace that we need to have in whenever anyone wants to offer feedback, whether it's like a helpful suggestion of, you know, when people say, "Oh, you mumbled," or you spoke really quickly, or and do you know who you're speaking to? The thing also with compliments, sometimes they land weirdly, but it's like this projection from their world. I mean, there's an interesting thing perhaps, you know, perhaps they didn't have the language for it in that moment. And I have my own suite of words that I'm allergic to. So, you know, just mutter some particular things and I'll have an exaggerated reaction. But I'm gonna weave in a few things here. I want to play with energy. Then we're going to have a little whiskey. There's this sense of like, perhaps, you know, if I was channeling in that person, I'd be like, there's energy, yes, but there's like a vitality. And it's also an enlivening presence, because part of the role of trickster, of jester, of fool, of all of these things is to, well, trickster is to invert paradigms, is to, you know, trickster comes to re-enliven things that have settled or ossified or stagnated, right? So there's this thing that you bring, and, you know, the jester to tell truth to those in power and to subvert, like, so elegantly, like, that is also an enlivening thing, because you want to have dynamics in place, and the fool to kind of to model an innocence and a naivete that all of us have, but many of us have kind of masked over with our professionalism, so on and so, and to kind of show up in this embodied form that brings the best of trickster, jester, and fool together with all the other talents of the bard and all these things has this thing where people will see you and be like, oh, you've got such energy, but perhaps they're like responding to how energized or how they enlivened their feeling because you've reminded them and reawakened them to you know, a deeper self.
I love that, brother. I love that. And I think I really believe that you're closer to it. And that's what I was getting at. I think I had it wrong. You know, I think I had an overly two-dimensional definition of what they meant and said and felt when they were saying energy. And I think, you know, I remember my friend Shane talking about it years ago and saying, well, it's also about the energy that you bring into the room, and then that emotional contagion that sort of ripples out to you, out from you into the people that you're trying to support. And I think that's part of it.
Yeah. I want to actually, there's a nice point there, if we're still talking shop for a little bit, like we'll delay whiskey for like another couple of minutes.
I'll give you 4 seconds.
the energy we bring, right? So there's this interesting thing where I'll be at this hotel, you know, despite my best efforts to remove all light sources and stuff like that, I'll have a pillow that's too high, I've had a crappy sleep and whatnot, and I'm grumbling and on social media, you know, even though I didn't want to be, and so on. And then there's this process of transitioning as you walk into the room, there's this embodiment or a different aspect that comes on you because you've got this amplified authenticity. Yes. I'm just curious, what are you doing to arrive in state? Because you do this as a performer too, right? You know, sharing your art and craft, and you don't want to be in a hypercritical loop where you're looking at everything. So what goes on for you to kind of bring this amplified?
That's such a great question. Well, I'll tell you what I do, my friend. I often think of a Bob Dylan song. In the lyrics, he says, you've got to serve somebody. This is sort of right there in the chorus. You've got to serve somebody. And so, and I can actually bring it all the way back to one of my first gigs. I remember I was, I won't name the client, but I was working for a big insurance company or with supporting one of them. And I was just trying to help them. One of my first gigs was helping them to speak better on the telephone. That was it. That was literally it. Speak better on the phone. But I was a kid. And when I say that, I was 20-ish. And I had just had my soul ripped out by a beautiful girl from the northern beaches of Sydney. She ruined me, Jason. Dashed me on the rocks. It was very visceral heartbreak. I thought I was going to marry her, and next minute she was gone. And I can remember this period so vividly because I'd already built the archetype as John, the smiley, fun guy. I'm going to bring the thunder. I'm going to make you all have a fun day and speak nicely on the phone. And I'd be coming up in the elevator, literally, brother, wiping tears out of my eyes, like wiping tears out of my eyes and just pulling myself together. And then I would throw the door open and step into the room. And the second I landed, it's not about me anymore. You know, it's not about me. There's something so freeing about it, isn't it? I can celebrate with you that it happened again in the most profound way 5 years ago when I became a dad. Like, I cannot tell you the relief, the weight that just came flushing off my shoulders when I was able to go, fuck yes, it's just not about me now. It's not. And so So that's my long answer to the question, Holmes. I can reemerge as the trickster and as the jester in a heartbeat as I cross a threshold. Mm-hmm. If I remind myself that I'm not there for myself, that's it.
That's beautiful. That is so well articulated. I love the sense of threshold that you brought in there. Having the awareness of the threshold moment where you transcend, where you literally transcend the smaller minded egoic, like, I can't be bothered being here and so on. And then you are here of service. You're so grateful to be here, but you're like, it's, yeah. Oh, that's phenomenal. I love that.
It's not
contemplate.
I think the reason why you and I love what we do and do well with what we do is because we've found a way to do it from a place of sincerity, you know. And another way to think about this too is that I don't think that you and I really talk about anything or share an idea unless we think that it's helpful. And I can admit that years ago, I would do something that even instinctively didn't feel like a great idea because it was a gig. You know, a client would give me a book. They'd give me a book and say, read this and write a program. And I'd read it and think, that's shit. And then I'd do it anyway because it's a gig.
Yeah.
But I had that breakthrough, you know, over a decade ago now. I thought, no, I'm not going to come here and do this unless I think that it's helpful and useful. And so there's something nice about that, isn't there? Maybe that's one of the many reasons why we relish in being a solo pro, because if it looks and feels funky, then you just don't do it, man. Just don't do it.
Yeah. Something feels off. Like, yeah.
Just don't be available. You don't even have to say no. Oh, that sounds great. I can help you in 8 months.
Yeah, totally. It's, oh man. I was resonating like it just left my mind. I was like, damn it. It's unreal time.
But you know what, Chase? I want to retract something I just said. I don't like how that sounded. It's not, oh, that sounds great. Let's do it in 8 months. That's not how we do it. I'll often say, in this example, I've read your book. I don't think it's going to fit or work for the landscape you described for me. And so if this is what you really feel like you need, then I suggest that you go and find someone else to help you with it. And brother, you know what happens every time? You know what happens every time? They go, oh, fuck that book. What book do you think we should?
Yeah, that's right. That's great. Yeah. I love that.
Jason, shall we?
Yeah, let's do it. I'm so ready. It's, as I was saying before, I've been renovating with a friend for like 3 days. This is so out of character for this wizard. I've been like hauling wood and stuff. Speaking of wood though, this one is the Mizunara wood reserve from Itirosmot.
Fantastic.
I've got my cat crawling.
Did you hear
the door.
That came through so nicely. That came through like an absolute, it was
oh good,
joyful.
good. Oh, we're going to get the glug at the moment as I pour mine. Okay.
Oh, that sounded like a generous
ball. It's a healthy dram. So here's the thing, right? Oh, cheers, buddy. I did this event once called Percolate where we had David Vitalik, Vitalis, the CEO of Starwood Whiskey, on stage. We're doing a whiskey tasting together.
Yes.
And I was going through all the motions and I had the whiskey. I did not taste the whiskey because I was so hyper aware and like I'm on stage and I'm doing all this stuff. Like I just wasn't present for it. So I love the moment when you do the nosing and stuff like that is unhurried and unrushed. And while so many people love to edit out all the so-called dead air on a podcast, I'm quite happy if we just take a moment. I think whoever's listening and joining us will forgive us.
I love that, mate. Nosing as we speak. Mizunara is such a beautiful thing to talk about. It's where we started. I don't know the exact math on it, but apparently it's 100 years of growth for these trees before they even consider chopping and turning them into a cask. So just think about that. We're not even talking about the age statement of the whiskey. The wood that it's in, the tree took 100 years. Think about that first.
Totally. Have you seen what they look like, right? They're so beautiful, the trees.
Beautiful.
And you think all the life that goes through, and then select in the reserves, and
what do you get on the nose? Oh, I often get honey on the nose with Mizanara.
Honey and a little bit of black pepper, maybe.
Yeah, there's something earthy there, but not overly, like, we're not talking stank, and we're certainly not in.
Yeah, just nice loamy soil, yeah.
Shall we have a little sip, my friend?
I already had one.
Sorry. See, I'm worried that I'm going to push you too quickly on this. All right.
So there's this thing that I got taught once, if you're tasting whiskey, and most people don't know this thing. So partly holding in your hand releases some of the alcohol, the ether, nosing it primes you. But the first sip, I kind of get in the same ratios as the saliva in my mouth, and I just hold it. I just cup it with my tongue to the roof of my mouth, let it diffuse. And then that means the next sip is like so golden. There's no burn. There's no burn because it's all unhurried, and I'm about to have my proper sip.
Mate, that is outstanding. I really like that idea from you about the first micro sip and trying to match the saliva ratio. You're essentially coating the inside of your mouth. You're getting it ready for action, which means you're not distracted by any kind of burn. And I imagine this would work really well with car strength whiskies as well, just to sort of distract yourself from that.
That's a nice one to hold inside you. I'm finding the finish is quite abrupt in this one.
It's dry, but I'm getting a lot of beautiful sort of orange peel.
Yes, citrus, yes.
Kind of notes from it.
You know,
I'm not finding are you finding that to be a bit of an aggro finish?
Just like I wanted, I was hoping for a little bit more linger. But you know, one of the things that you and I love, let me tell you what you and I love, is. Whiskey tasting notes, when you read them, they're just so honest. They don't hold back. They describe the whole pantheon of the experiences. And, you know, I know you're part of the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society, right?
Yes.
Some of the tasting notes on that, like, we've seen phrases like fresh Band-Aid and,
you know, that's one of the things that we love doing that. Jason, you and I love sending each other bogus notes. Like, I remember I was in Coolangatta a few months ago and we were talking about neglected Band-Aid bobbing against pool filter.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. The smell of an old cigarette butt that has been discarded in a petrol station. Like,
yeah, exactly. 7-Eleven floor at 1:45 a.m. Can't have a pop stick and half noshed nutter. But this is part of it too, because again, we're talking about someone else's interpretation, and sometimes I'll say things that don't sound palatable, but just holding that in your mind's eye and letting that bounce in your imagination enhances the experience. And, you know, it's that other thing too, isn't it? You can look for meaning in anything and you can find it there. And so that's why I'm often sort of excited to read someone else's notes, but I'll do it after I've tasted it. I'll taste it, take a little amateur run at what I can taste, and then read what someone else say about it, so that I'm not so corrupted.
Let's weave some of this stuff in together, right? Because there is something to be said about a more poetic disposition, and by that I mean you're having an emphasis more on qualitative sensibilities. You're not kind of trying to be too rigid and narrow and metric, and it's the same in terms of what I was suggesting before about, you know, both of our websites aren't necessarily clear, although I think yours, you know, definitely people can sense where it is. But there's something to be said about one's own myth, right? Because people hear of you, there's kind of what you present to them, and then there's what they know of you based upon what others have said, which then means that people experience the myth of J.A., and the myth of J.A. is a combination of the, you know, beautiful profile picture, how you show up, the videos and so on. And then it's like talking to a friend. It's like, oh, yeah, I know J.A. He's fantastic and so on. And then there's this deeper point around consistently showing up with kindness and just like being a good person, you know, like just, and all of that permeates this kind of perception of you. And there's the parallels of the whiskey is like, yeah, there might be tasting notes and so on out there, but if they're not too prescriptive, they're not promising you, you're not going to get all of these things. And there's this, you know, you kind of, the context is there, but you just meet the experience and the presence for wherever you're at. And that's what I love about whiskey. Because I could have this on another day with another person and the tasting experience could be quite different.
You're on the money. And, you know, it's a lovely analogy too, because if you think about it, when it comes to whiskey, often we're also allured towards something because of reputation, you know? So you'll say, okay, I know that distillery. I know its legacy. I recognize the label. I've had a version of that, you know, in a different context somewhere in the past. And so part of that galvanizes the appeal, doesn't it? Because it's in its own way, it's half known to you, even if you've never done it. The other thing that I love so much is that sometimes you'll be in the middle of sipping one and you know without question that you're never going to taste it again. This is one of those moments in time, you know, and you're forever chasing after it. And I love that. I love that sort of
I thought you meant never tasting it. It's like, this is so shit. I'm never tasting this again.
you're spitting it down the sink. No,
you're making a more generous point. I like that. Yeah.
Oh man, it happened. Like, often it's when you're somewhere really weird. Like I remember being, you know, in a fantastic bar in Kyoto with my wife 6 years ago. You know those awesome places in Japan where you think you're walking into a residential building and then you go up eight floors and it turns out every floor is a beautiful speakeasy. Yeah. And I remember I was drinking this Bowmore Double the Devil, like it had gone from an Oloroso cask, you know, into a Jimenez. And I remember sort of, you know, of course it's about context too. You're in Kyoto with you're with your miracle wife. It's snowing outside. But knowing that you're never going to get that back, you know, it's that kind of, you know, that, have you seen that quote from Homer in the Iliad where he says something like, we are so lucky in that because we are doomed, you'll never be more lovely than you are now. We will never be here again. And there's something so magic about that, isn't there?
That's so beautiful. And there is a Japanese word that describes very close to what you're suggesting there, ichigo ichie, which is this particular moment, this particular combination of people, this particular context will never happen again. And there's some, you know, deep presencing to that. And looping it back, sorry, I hope I'm not too ham-fisted at my kind of a points, you know.
Jason, never apologize for the thing that leaves your lips.
This is the magic that I think so many people forget about when it gather people together for an event. It's not about the pithy tweetable statements or someone's presentation deck, or it's like there is a sublime magic to there's this quote by James Lee Byers, he was a mystic, to arrive at the edge of the world's knowledge, gather the smartest people in an industry together and put them in the room together and have them ask each other the questions they're asking themselves. And there's something about that surfacing, right? And part of our role is to tend to that fire, but we're not the ones that have the light and the answers and so on. We're just like part of the dance that helps to conjure this, you know, sublime profundity.
We are the energy that links that web together. And
well, look at you using the energy word now. You're
healed. Hey, look at me coming around to it. But mate, I think that quote hit me hard because what I took from it was when you said, answer the questions that they're asking themselves. You know, there's something so beautiful about this because now we're back into the nucleus of emergence. You know, if you can help people, answer the questions they're asking themselves, then that's an entire reason to put them in the cauldron in the first place.
Yeah, have them in the context where they can actually just ask each other the questions. And even, I think it's quite profound. Like, I think answers are relatively cheap these days. You know, AI could just spit out whatever answer you want. But a context where folks can genuinely grapple and contend and appreciate the bigger questions that they just don't get time to have. And even if they don't arrive at any answer, if there's a deeper sense of knowingness or kindredness or connection or enlivening or something like that, if they're enlivened and attuned to these beautiful, more beautiful questions, like that's a good thing in my book.
Well, it's matinee, and often I think as well, you know, in the context we're talking about, when you are in an event and you feel yourself in a safe, supportive environment, often you celebrate your ability to drop the facade. You drop that character, that archetype, that version of yourself, you know, that you that you often have to play within your household or when you're at work, you know, when you're out with your mates at the pub, you get to let all that fall away, because the relationships are often so new, and sometimes they're spawned in that moment, that you just get to show up in a way that's a bit more naked. And I think that's useful, because then people can see you.
I think that is true of an event that is well designed, where speakers are bringing their ability to hold context more so than just to dish out content. And I'd say that the majority of the strategy, leadership offsites and events that, like this magic you're talking about, the majority of it happens in this brief window between 9:30 p.m. and 1:30 a.m. after the dinner. There's this, like, at the bar, and people are dropping the things. And it's not about getting drunk or anything like that. It's just the context. Mm-hmm. And we've done all the official stuff. We've had the conversations, but we're here together, and the jokes and the humor. And the humor is both disarming and it's also leveling. The CEO is suddenly, like, on the same playing field as everyone else, and everyone's like, and just, we're just hanging out and, like, connecting with each other as friends. And it's just like, guys, everyone, this is available all the time. Like, you're all these beautiful people all the time. Like, do we have to do this kind of professional dance where we don the armor and, you know, adorn the seriousness? Or can we just, like, hang out and just relate as authentically as we can? And it's tricky to get there, but it's possible to get there. Events
you can get there. You can get there if you want to be there. And it's... I think the biggest missing piece is the awareness. You know, one of the things that I remember absolutely floored me a few years ago when I read it, it was a quote from a guy named Anthony DeMello, and he said, what you're aware of, you're in control of. What you're not aware of is in control of you. You know, and I think a lot of people will show up to these events, and if it comes with an agenda, I'm going to meet someone, I'm going to network, I'm going to give you my business card, I'm going to ask you who you're playing. There's something so just two-dimensional and shallow about
it. Yeah.
It's a decision to get nothing from it, because you've rolled in with an agenda, and it's already corrupted, isn't it?
It's that I think the heart of corruption, not all of it, but a lot of it, comes in with this quest for optimization. We need to be so careful with it. I heard someone say that, like, with networking, you need to know the top three people you want to speak to, research in advance, figure out how you can capture them. I'm like, it's so clinical and mechanical. Goddard's law is when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to become a good measure. And so if you've got this thing of, like, I'm going to meet 12 people or blah, 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 it's like, just chill, just, like, open yourself to serendipity, you know, place yourself, listen, attune, serve, be present.
Don't come, you know. It was funny, when you and I partied probably for the first time in Brisbane, I remember coming home from that event with Leanne and Michael, and my wife said to me, how was the event? And I was like, oh, it wasn't about the event at all. I wasn't there for the events, you know. And, of course, the event was great, and it was lovely hearing from them both. But what we never could have seen coming was everything that happened afterwards. You know, it was all the hang. It was the banter in the Uber on the way to the restaurant. You know, it was the ouzo. It was things that you never could have predicted. But I think sometimes that's the biggest glitch, is people aren't open to throwing themselves into the abyss, you know, unless there's an agenda or a strong idea of what it is they hope to optimize, then they're reluctant to roll the dice.
I really do like jazz as the analogy here, because, like, a good jazz musician, and I think I'm borrowing this from Michael Dixon, who brought me aware of this, but, like, you have your sets, like, you have your bits, you have, like, bits that you can land, a way you can open, a way you can close and stuff like that, but there's plenty of space to breathe and to improvise and so on. And there's this approach to generative ambiguity where you want to kind of set the container, but you also don't want to crowd out all of that emergence. But speaking of emergence, I've got on my list of things to do, fake ad. Are we still going to do this?
It's time for a fake agenda. Ad. It's time for a fake ad. I'd say to set up the fake ad, I'll play our theme music.
Do you ever struggle with office banter? Coming up with something fresh to say in the harrowing elevator trip to the ground floor? Download ChatGPT Gamangotchi Pocket Banter and keep your whimsy fresh. Dish it up observational. Four seasons in one day in Kentucket, am I right, Jennifer? Stay present. If only the kitchen had a mezcal dispenser, hey fellas? Stay topical. Did you catch the game on the weekend? How good is Eddinghausen? ChatGPT Tamagotchi. Enhance your pants.
Yeah. Hot damn.
Do you struggle to... Okay. That'll be good to drop in. That's going to be good.
All right. Okay, good. Oh, so we're not doing... Oh, yeah, that's right. We're doing up... Yeah, great. Okay, good. Yeah,
I like your idea about, like, dropping that. Because if we drop it in post, then we can, like, put a soundtrack and stuff under it. It'll be fun.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah. our biggest risk is we overcook, like, the amount of stuff that we do. Shall we do some bad advice?
Let's do bad advice.
Okay.
I'll go first.
Okay.
Before going to a networking event, you need to research your top five people. Keep your eye on the target and don't go home without 15 business cards.
That's right. Yeah. And clarity. It's all about clarity in this day and age. There's so much noise. You need to know exactly what you are, who you are, what you stand for, what you do, who you serve, where and when. Whenever you have a client engagement, know exactly how it's going to unfurl. Have the wisdom and the foresight and the omnipotence and omnipresence to know exactly how everything will unfurl and plan accordingly. Make sure you have plenty of slides to deal with every single situation that can emerge. Don't trust yourself. Don't trust the audience. Don't trust the client. Trust in the technology.
At the start of every workshop, begin by saying, hold all of your questions until the end, and then paying close attention to your facilitator guide. Don't miss a slide and don't allow anyone to knock you off script.
That's right. If you're looking to build social media presence, it's important that you consistently show up with a consistent message at the same time every day. Consistency is key here. Did I say consistency? So your message must be clear and readable and easy for the artificial intelligences to disperse on the internet. Consistency.
That was consistent. See, this is a good segment, but it runs the risk of going for too long. Like, I've got about 10 other things that I'd like to say. But this is good. I think bad advice is a nice thing to drop in.
All right, great. It's just some reflections.
Okay. Well, the first thing I really enjoyed that you said was when I tried to get you to when I said to you, don't tell me your origin story, and then asked for your origin story, and then you said to me in your own delightful way, no, right? that was interesting, you know, because in your own way you answered my question, because I was sort of inferring around the dangers of rigid self-construct, and you were, what I sort of heard you saying to me was that one of the great ways to not do that is just to be careful around the way that you flash back how it is you became who it is that you say you are. And you almost seem to refuse to go there, which I found really interesting.
Yeah, that's cool. I know we're reflecting at the moment, but there's also, I mean, I do want to say there is some utility in having some sort of groomed narrative to deploy in situations where you must, like a biography, or you're just in one of those podcasts where you know that folks aren't necessarily going to be as convivial to all the ambiguity. So it's nice. But then you can also still, like, have ironic sincerity with it. So, like, 'cause I sometimes refer to my biography as my glittered Trojan horse, you know, where I, you know, tarted up my own biography so as to effectively sneak into Enterprise land past the cognitive gatekeepers. So, yeah, I mean, I loved your real time. I love it when folks catch elegies and they're just like, I'm having a funny reaction to the word energy, or like, this is interesting. And then to kind of in real time, quickly do this interoceptive, contemplative, reflective analysis of like, hey, why is that? And there's this felt sense and this presencing, and you did it like so swiftly, and then kind of arrived at this like synthesis, which is, you know, not abandoning all of that, but like just transcending and transmuting it into a form that, is metastable at higher orders of complexity. But I liked that process. That was lovely. I just want to say, and just encouraging that in all of us, like whenever you feel this, you mentioned it before, like with the funk, when something feels wrong, when you feel that sense, your body feels it and stuff like that, well, lean into that.
Yeah, exactly. What is that? And I love that, because what we're agreeing on here is you need to pay attention with intention, but you also need to really entertain that you, quite often your lens, your interpretation, you know, your angle and your perspective is completely buckled. And I love that if you're willing to get into that, often what you'll do as a reflex is start to amass a tribe around yourself of people who instinctively you feel are going to challenge your thought domains, create paradigm shifts, you know, blow open perspective. And isn't that the point? You know, why would we want to be shrouded in birds of a feather, Fizzle? That's boring.
I'm missing the second half of this. You might know the thing is, like, I heard someone say, ours is a society that is optimized for comfort. And we think we're optimizing for happiness, but happiness is just this, like, comfort thing. What is that? What is that? It begins with U-E. What's the...
Oh, that's interesting.
Eudaimonia. That? Eudaimonia. Right. I think that's... I mean, that's a little bit of a buzzword, but there's a sense of, like, yeah, you want to kind of be, you know, you want to be enlivened by those around you. You want to be inspired by the company you keep, to quote a friend of mine.
My friend. Well, that's why I love hanging out with you. It's always a pleasure. It's always a privilege.
That's why we're kindred spirits.
You said it, my man. And I think every time we come together, there's an unpredictable, delightfully disruptive alchemy. And I can only hope that this is the first of many, Jay Fizzle.
Yeah. Shout out to the kindred spirits who have joined us as listeners. We love you. And hope you had fun with us. And we'll look forward to hanging out with you next time.
Until next time. See you, legend.
Oh, do you want to slap the theme music?
Yeah. Oh, please. Any excuse to hit this bad boy. See you, legend.